House Committee on Land Use. We hereby start the afternoon's proceedings, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2458. And I'll have Representative Jensen and Harlan Levy will come forward. Mr. Administrator, tell us what the bill is about.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Members of Committee.
Briefly, House Bill 2258 modifies the existing law in three ways. First, like a bill that you had, yes, 2458. The existing law had a sunset clause. This will remove that sunset clause. The second thing, unlike a previous one that you had had testimony on about 3 weeks back, this one will allow abandoned mill sites to have be used for industrial or for future commercial uses. And the third change is that it amends the location standard for land that's going to be used for, considered for use for 3 miles outside a urban growth boundary, and increases the population size of a city from 15,000 to 25,000. With that, I would end the SMS.
Members, we have at the moment 8 different persons signed up to testify in regards to 2458, and we also like to recognize and welcome Representative Ravakian, will be sitting in with our committee today.
That's thank you, Mr. Chair.
Harlan and Representative Jensen, good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58. House District 58 encompasses the majority of both people and land maps of Umatilla County. It occupies a very small sliver of Union County that to date I have yet to be able to find anyone registered to vote in that particular real estate. But I can still claim some of Union County, I guess, you know, with that. And thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 2458 before the committee. I appreciate very much your hearing it. The bill comes to us initially because of a request from the Oregon Association of Realtors, and has the support and endorsement of the local communities in House District 58. Basically, it originates because of a problem that the city of Hermiston and the county, I guess, had on an area just north of Hermiston on Highway 395, where the local businesses were unable to expand their businesses in the way that was necessary because of the restrictions, I guess, that had been put on them by the land use the LCDC commission. And I am going to leave the presentation specifically of the bill and the fine points of that to Mr. Levy. And with that, I would introduce Harlan Levy with the Oregon Realtors, acting in also in some respects with the citizens of Umatilla County, or for Umatilla County. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to answer any questions if you have them before.
Just one quick note. As you recall, I was chair of the interim committee that went to Hermiston.
Yes.
And took a lot of this testimony. You were there that night. And it was probably the highlight of our interim travels, meeting the good people of Hermiston.
We were delighted to have the committee there. We truly appreciated the work the committee did. And we appreciated any and all of the money that was spent in Umatilla County while you were there. As such, we would always welcome you back, you know, and remind you that there are two great rodeos in Umatilla County. One is well known as the Roundup. The other one is the rodeo that's held in Hermiston. Both are great shows, a good place to come. and enjoy yourself and spend your money.
Have you checked with the sheriff to make sure we really are welcome back?
I can assure you that
the sheriff will welcome you back during those two particular occasions, additionally.
We'll be right back with the weather after our next commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Levy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I did want to offer our deep thanks to Representative Jensen for sponsoring this bill. This bill will have an impact not only on his community but on other rural communities around the state of Oregon, and we really do appreciate his support for this particular issue. I wanted to start my testimony with a little bit of background information to familiarize the committee with this particular issue. Oregon's land use program requires that local governments plan and zone all the private lands. Every square foot of private land in the state is zoned for a particular use. That is different from many states. But in Oregon, all private property, all private lands have to be zoned. We have three basic types of land, in the state of Oregon. We have urban land, resource land, and exception land. There are some other very minuscule amounts of non-resource land. I don't want to get into that here. I'm going to focus on these three types that we're talking about. Now, urban land is land that you find inside of urban growth boundaries. Resource land is farm and forest land, which is by far the largest percentage of private property in the state. About 97% of all the private land outside of urban growth boundaries is resource land. The remaining 3% is called exception land. That is what we're talking about here. Exception land is land that has already received an exception to the natural resource rules, goals 3 and 4. For whatever reason, this land has been identified as not being subject to the farm and forest land protection goals. Now, of this 3% resource land, exception land, our bill deals with a very small percentage of that even. We're talking about rural industrial and rural commercial lands, which constitute approximately one half of 1% of all the private land outside of urban growth boundaries. We're not talking about a lot of land here, members of the committee. We're talking about areas that are already planned and already zoned for rural industrial or rural commercial uses, a very small percentage of the land mass of the state of Oregon. Now, when county plans were acknowledged by LCDC back in the 1980s, these lands, these rural industrial and rural commercial lands, were allowed to continue in their development patterns to allow for economic growth for these counties, to allow for jobs and job creation and economic development. That was part of the plan. However, in 1986, in a Supreme Court decision known as the Curry County case, the court said that in this particular case, LCDC was violating Goal 14, the urbanization goal, by allowing Curry County to allow urban uses, or so-called urban uses, on the rural lands. Remember, these are rural, industrial, rural commercial lands outside of urban growth boundaries. And in this case, the court told LCDC they had to remand the case back to the county because they were violating Goal 14 and allowing for so-called urban uses on rural lands. And that was in violation of the goal. The court did not tell us what an urban use was or what a rural use was. They left that up in the air for future determinations. And as a result, over the years, you've had a lot of case-by-case analysis of various fact situations to determine what is an urban use versus what is a rural use. Well, that brings us to the need for our bill, House Bill 2458. The situation that you have today is many of these counties are in periodic review. That means that their comprehensive plans are being looked at by by the department and ultimately by LCDC to ensure that they still comply with the statewide planning goals and the interpretations of those goals over the years. With respect to this particular issue, this Curry County issue, as we call it these days, counties are being forced, in many cases, to downzone the rural industrial, rural commercial lands. And when I say downzone, what I'm talking about is telling the counties they have to adopt building size limits. And in some cases, these size limits have been pretty extreme. You have a 3,500 square foot building size limitation for commercial lands. In some cases, you have 35,000 square foot limitations in industrial lands. Some of the numbers have fluctuated, and LCDC has increased some of the limitations with respect to unincorporated communities in a recent rulemaking. But the bottom line is they are requiring these building size limits to be imposed in order to comply with their read of Goal 14 and this Curry County decision. Now, this takes a lot of flexibility away from the counties, as you might imagine. They want to plan for their own economic development, as they have over the past 30 years. And they want to continue doing what they've been doing. It also can trigger, now that we're in a post-Measure 37 world, some significant liability if the counties are forced to impose these new building size limits that had not existed prior to them going into periodic review. This is a couple examples of counties that have recently faced these building size limits being imposed on them, and Umatilla, Josephine, Jackson, Lane, and Klamath counties are the ones that I've listed. If you look in the testimony that I've submitted to you, I do have, I have attached a resolution from the Klamath County Board of Commissioners in support of this bill, as well as the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners in support of this bill, and a letter from the Josephine County Commissioners in support of this bill. I've also attached a recent newspaper article from the East Oregonian that specifically explains the situation that Umatilla County has been facing with these building size limits. You may hear some testimony today that the exceptions process is the proper process to deal with these issues, that all that needs to happen is a county needs to just take an exception to the requirements of Goal 14, and that will solve the problem that you don't need to pass this bill. Well, I submit to you that that is not a solution. The exceptions process is an ad hoc decision-making process that applies to specific fact scenarios, and the bottom line is exceptions are very difficult to meet. Even in Umatilla County, which has generated significant publicity in the past several months, the Goal 14 exception that they requested was only partially granted. It was not granted in its entirety. That is what the newspaper article describes. Furthermore, exceptions are subject to appeal. And, you know, like any other land use decision, you can find yourself embroiled in litigation for months, years, decades, as the process goes back and forth and various parties become unhappy with the decisions. And we submit to you that it is not good land use planning to create a rule and then expect that everybody that's affected by it needs to take an exception to get around the parameters of that rule. We think the rule ought to be changed. The rule ought to be different. Instead of relying on an exceptions process, which is supposed to be the exception rather than the norm. Now, during the last legislative session, you passed and the governor signed House Bill 2614, which was a partial and temporary fix to this problem. The fix was partial because it only applied to rural industrial lands, and it was temporary because the bill has a sunset clause built into it, and that sunset will sunset in 2006. The bill that is before you today will remove that sunset. It will also include the other types of employment land that counties need to plan for economic development, that is commercial. And it will adjust the population threshold. We built in a population threshold in 2614 to alleviate some concerns that larger cities might have had. That threshold threshold was at 15,000. Right now, the city of Hermiston is very close to 15,000. We wanted to make sure that any legislation that is passed that addresses this situation would also be capable to be used by that community as well. So we have increased that population threshold from 15,000 to 25,000. So, in conclusion,
Representative Greenman.
We're talking now about Section A of Subsection 2 of Section 1, I think. Is that what line, we're down on line 18 and 19.
Chair Garrod, Representative Greenman, that is correct. You're looking at page 1, line 19 and line 21 changes that population.
Is that a population that, at first reading, this looks like it can only work in cities that are larger than 25,000? Is that what that's supposed to mean?
Chair Garrod, Representative Greenlich, no. What this section of the bill does, and what this section of House Bill 2614 from last session did, is it said that cities above a particular population would not have these uses cited within 3 miles of their urban growth boundary. There was concern by some of those larger cities that they would be competing for these particular projects, and that was purely a political provision we built into it to try to alleviate some of their concerns. The problem we were having today, frankly, is that, you know, some of the cities that, some of the areas that we're really trying to address here are very close to that 15,000 threshold.
Can I continue? Listen, what it says is that it says under two above, 16 and 17, that a county may consider the following lands for industrial or commercial development. And then A, if it's more than 3 miles outside the urban growth boundary of those cities, is that what it says? So it can't be within 3 miles. This is only land outside the urban, either outside the urban growth boundary or A and B seem to me to be contradictory, and I'm just not reading it. Is that the problem? Would you help me read it?
I can help you read it. Chair Garrod, Representative Greenlich, perhaps it isn't the model of clarity in drafting, but what it says is that you cannot, as a county, you cannot approve one of these building sizes within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary of a city with a population of, in this case, 25,000 or more. But you can permit it outside, anywhere outside the urban growth boundary of a city with a population of less than 25,000.
Right, thank you. I see.
Mr. Chair, now you've confused me.
Representative Greenwich has a tendency to do that to all of us.
I understand that. And
it was a clarifying question. It was a confusing answer, I'm sure.
Mr. Levy, is there an outer limit to the second part of that area? Anywhere outside a small city's urban growth boundary. Unincorporated area in Multnomah County is anywhere outside the urban growth boundary of Heppner, for example. I don't even know if they have an urban growth boundary. But is there an outer limit?
Chair Garrod, Representative Nolan, there is no outer limit. But remember, this bill does not apply to Willamette Valley, so Multnomah County is not affected whatsoever by this bill.
Deschutes County, then.
If you were talking about Deschutes County, then you would need to cite one of these things, again, on land that's already planned and zoned for these uses, that's been existing in that zoning since January 1st of 2004. If you have land that is already planned and zoned for that use, and in this case, if it's more than 3 miles from a city of 25,000 or anywhere outside of a city of less than 25,000, you could, as a county, approve one of these proposals.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
But, for example, you could have territory that is within 3 miles of the urban growth boundary of a city of 25,000. But it also is anywhere outside the urban growth boundary of another city. So doesn't the second descriptor eliminate the first description?
Representative, in Eastern Oregon, we don't have two cities of 25,000 that close to each other.
But, Mr. Chair, that's why I asked whether there was an outer limit.
Chair, you're right, Representative Nolan. The two provisions are supposed to be exclusive. You're not supposed to be able to do it anywhere within 3 miles of a city of 25,000 individuals or more. I mean, that, I'll put that on the record. That was our intent. If it doesn't read that way and if it needs to be clarified, then I'm happy to do that. But that is the intention. Nowhere within 3 miles of a city of 25,000 or more.
Thank you.
Okay. So in conclusion, Mr. Chair, what this bill does is it returns some local control to county commissioners so that they can plan for economic development on lands that have already been zoned for this purpose for many years. It does not force counties to take any particular action. It does not force them to approve any particular application. It is completely permissive, and counties may choose not to use the bill if that is their wish. House Bill 2614, the bill that passed last session, in the limited 2 years in which it has existed on the books, has already created over 100 jobs. That's the testimony that you heard from the counties about a month ago. So we're off to a good start here, and we want to see that trend continue. And as for sideboards, this bill contains some pretty significant sideboards. And again, I'll mention it again. The most significant is it does not apply to the Willamette Valley. And the Willamette Valley is a statutory term defined in ORS 215.010 as Clackamas, Lynn, Marion, Multnomah, Polk, Washington, and Yamhill County, as well as the portions of Benton and Lane counties that lie to the east of the summit of the Coast Range. So right then and there, we've carved off the biggest population centers of the state of Oregon. Secondly, we're not going to allow any land to be rezoned to meet the parameters of this bill. The land must have been zoned and planned for these uses on January 1st, 2004. It is a grandfathering bill. We are not letting anybody go out there and rezoning any type of resource or other land to meet this purpose. Again, we're talking about less than one-half of 1% of the private lands outside of urban growth boundaries. Third, there is no extension of urban services allowed by this bill, period. You know, there are statewide planning goals and administrative rules that talk about not allowing the extension of sewer outside of urban growth boundaries. This bill does not change those. The bill speaks to an on-site sewer facility. It allows you to put in an on-site facility if the carrying capacity of that particular parcel will carry an on-site facility. So there are natural limitations there as well. Finally, and we've talked about this now a couple of times, the bill protects cities with a population larger than 25,000 from a county approving any of these uses within 3 miles of its urban growth boundary. It also requires that notice be sent out to all cities within 10 miles of one of these proposals, and that the city and county work together to mitigate any problems that that city might have with the proposal before the county. So we think that there are some pretty significant sideboards built into this bill. We think it is a responsible and necessary land use reform. We think that it will save a significant amount of liability in the form of Measure 37 claims that will come if the department continues to force counties to downzone their lands, and we would urge this committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Lee, have you done an inventory of land that would be able to benefit from this bill?
Chair Gerard, Representative Norman, I have not done an inventory. The information that I have is from the House Bill 2614 last session. Those numbers were provided by the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I would be happy to go back in my files and present that to this committee. I know that the counties are asking, the county planning directors are trying to ascertain how much land is out there today in a more specific survey. You may hear testimony on that later geared towards this bill, but the numbers that I have are from the department from last session.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow
up. I'd appreciate getting what information you have from the last session, but it seems to me, and I don't know how many of these mapping systems are computerized, but given the definitions in here, the distance definition plus the existing zoning definition, it would seem to me it wouldn't be all that hard to produce a map that would identify where these parcels might be, and it might actually help us understand the targeting that I think you're trying to tell us you're doing.
Chair Gerard, Representative Nolan, I agree. We really would like to have that information, and I would hope the committee would ask that representatives from the counties that have this information, many of them do have GIS systems, some of them have older types of systems, but I would think that it is available out there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's all been compiled. I think it's probably going to be in a county-by-county basis, but it would be good information to have.
Thanks.
Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Arlen.
Thank you.
In an effort that the committee always tries to do is take testimony first from people who came the furthest distance. So, Campbell Mabbitt, Umatilla County. You might have a long shot of getting back home before dark.
Oh, thank you. Actually, we're staying over. We have some more business today. Thank you very much for having this hearing, for hearing the bill, and for allowing me. I traveled about 250 miles this morning, but who's complaining? You travel farther than that. My name is Tamara Mabbitt. I'm the planning director in Umatilla County. I'm also currently the president of the Association of Oregon County Planning Directors. I am here today representing Umatilla County, not all of the county planning directors, but I may share some anecdotal information from them as well. Representative Nolan, you ask a good question about the mapping and the inventory. I have personally undertaken that effort and asked all of the counties to submit that information. I'm hoping in the next couple of weeks we will have that information in database form. I don't know if we'll get it in GIS because there's lots of counties that don't have GIS, but we can give you some relative information that would be helpful. And I think that question is so important that, and the counties do as well, because whether or not you choose to support this bill will, in my opinion, be based in large part on how big of an effect this would actually have on individual counties and the statewide land use program. Once that information is back, my gut feeling is that, particularly in eastern Oregon, passage of this bill will not in any way undermine the state land use program. We are required in eastern Oregon to comply with 14 statewide planning goals, not all of them, because we don't have a Willamette Green Bay or the coast. And goal 14 is probably one of our more challenging statewide planning goals that we're required to comply with. Umatilla County, through our periodic review over the past 10 years, has been grappling with a number of issues, and our last issue to complete to show, convince the department and the Land Conservation and Development Commission that we're still up to snuff with implementing our program has to do with this Goal 14 issue, which is why it's so important and is certainly worth a trip down here. Chair Gerard and the rest of representatives who attended the hearing in Hermiston in June, thank you very much. That did a lot for speaking for the Oregon legislature. It spoke well of the state program, and it endeared those folks in all of our county, particularly West County, to know that lots of you would take time out of your busy schedules to come and hear about this important issue. Umatilla County is supportive of this. Mr. Levy submitted with his testimony a copy of a letter from our three county commissioners indicating their support for it. We are open to making amendments to clarify language if some of it's more confusing than it needs to be. That's kind of the nature of legislation, I think. But in general, we're very supportive of it. I've polled the cities in Umatilla County, and we don't have any over 15,000. Mr. Jarrett is correct in that. And I have not polled all of the Eastern Oregon cities, but I believe most of those cities are very supportive. You'll hear from League of Cities today as well, and she'll be able to clarify that issue. Umatilla County is very supportive of this measure. If I had my druthers, the measure would go one step further, and that would declare that any county with lands that are currently zoned for commercial and industrial use will not be subjected to a building size limit, and those lands will be recognized as in compliance with State Planning Goal 14. That latter part is very important. We might not get there with this particular bill, but it is important. I'm not.
Just to remind us that Goal 14 is the urbanization goal.
Yes.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. That was part of my. I didn't want to test you today, but I wasn't sure how familiar this committee is with statewide Goal 14, nor how familiar you are with the Curry County case. One of my tests or gauges of public knowledge about the statewide land use program is to ask them if they know about Curry County, and most people who know anything about it, their eyes glaze over and roll under the back of their heads. And even some of those of us who are familiar with it and make a business out of planning are a little frustrated with that law. It has been frustrating as a county planning director who runs a relatively popular program, at least for being in the regulatory business, to have to explain to folks, gosh, you know, you've been planned and zoned it for 30 years. But because through periodic review we're required to comply with Goal 14, we're going to have to tell you your building can't be larger than 3,500 square feet. Well, they say, Planner Rabbit, my building is already 4,000 square feet, and I'd really like to expand. So our economic development folks say, wow, that's a real dilemma. Why is that? Well, it's the way we comply with Goal 14. And I do think our county is supportive of the land use program. It does many very good things. But I think this flexibility provided in this law is something particularly Eastern Oregon cities and counties need, both to preserve the integrity of the program, to preserve their property rights, and a little more selfishly to help us through our periodic review process and to facilitate economic development in our own respective counties. So in summary, I would say that the bill meets part of our local wish list that recognizes existing commercial and industrial lands. The sidebar Mr. Levy just spoke about is very important. And if you postpone this, I understand you're considering that, not making a decision today. Hopefully in a few weeks we can get you this database and hopefully a map that tells you just how big the issue is. And you may already be aware, I know there's some folks from the Department of Land Conservation and Development here today. The Land Conservation Development has a subcommittee working on this issue. It's the Rural, Commercial, and Industrial Subcommittee. I'm participating on that. Several other counties, cities, Thousand Friends of Oregon, Oregon Needs in Action, Oregon Association of Realtors. We're dealing with this issue. You may hear some folks ask you to defer a decision on this and wait for that subcommittee work to be completed. I think that your support of this bill would complement what we're doing, based in large part on the scope of the issue which Representative Nolan has asked you about today. So I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Ms. Madden? You are Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you for your testimony. Tell me a little bit about the limitation that says you cannot extend any sewer or infrastructure to the property. Are there provisions for you through septic or package treatment? How do you deal with that?
Well,
Goal 11, statewide planning goal 11, public utilities, prohibits expansion of city or municipal sewer service. So there is a limit on the size of buildings. Because of that, there is a really sort of a natural development limitation on the size those buildings may expand. Many buildings, like Home Depot, for example, is looking in our area. They wanted to be inside city limits because even though they'd like to be outside city limits, property's a little bit cheaper or a lot cheaper, they wanted city sewer and city water pressure so they can meet fire code and be hooked up to a municipal system. So Goal 11 complements this, in my opinion. It provides the necessary growth limitation, so you're not looking at massive structures outside the urban growth boundary. Did that answer your question?
No.
Okay.
Seeing no other questions, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Let's have Art Schlack, Linda Ludwig, and Randy Tucker. The Counties, the Cities, and Metro Committee. Ask Mr. Tucker what the Metro interests are. But I didn't do that, Randy.
You did a box check.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2458 with one possible amendment at this point. As you know, the Association of Oregon Counties has submitted House Bill 2162, which you heard several weeks ago. And House Bill 2162 does remove the sunset clause that it relates to the industrial development. Which was established in House Bill 2614 from the 2003 session. We worked very diligently with a variety of groups of people to fashion House Bill 2614 that has all the limitations that you've been discussing here today. It only applies outside the Willamette Valley. There is an additional ring around cities over 15,000 people and requires notice of cities when the county is going to take an action, and a number of different factors to set some parameters to allow industrial development. The Association of Oregon Counties supports adding commercial to that list of activities, but we do that with a recognition of the criteria that was established in House Bill 2614. To be very specific, the only change from the bill that you have in front of you is the question of population of cities. We would support the 15,000 that was agreed upon in 2614. We know that there is a concern about the city of Hermiston at this point. We understand there are about 12,000 currently, so they do have some room to grow before they would be over the 15,000 limitation. We think adding commercial, there's benefit to that at this point. Building size limitation in and of itself is not necessarily a good criteria for what's urban and what's rural. The landform is really in a lot of respects a better criteria. The legislation that was passed in 2003 allows on-site sewage facilities, both in-ground and a package treatment plant. It does not it is not extended to the connection to a municipal sewer system for these kinds of activities. And that in and of itself is a limitation on the intensity of development in these rural areas at this point. The land has to support it, and that has for years was a criteria. So, Mr. Chair, we support 2458. It does something that we strongly support, as you, Mr. Chair, and the committee knows, and that is the removal of the sunset that was placed on 2614, and it's the subject of the other bill that you've considered several weeks ago at this point. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond to those.
Seeing none.
Thank you.
Linda?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. The league does have some concerns with this bill that I'll describe in a couple of minutes. And we feel that they would probably best be resolved in the work group that you heard about that DLCD has now convened. But that having been said, we are more than willing to work with AOC and the Realtors Association to see if we can draft some amendments to bring us together to support this bill. I initially offered a couple of options to strengthen the city objection criteria in Section 2, Sub 2, on the back of the bill, or by providing yet another sunset provision to the commercial portion of this bill, but we have not come to agreement on any of those things yet, so I wanted to mention those things to you today. As you can see before you...
I have to say at this point that the chair wouldn't be much interested in a sunset. And I have to tell you that because I don't think people in business can plan for construction with a sunset under authorization. Either you do this or you don't do it. Okay? That's my feeling on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see by the comments by cities that I've provided to you today, cities feel very strongly about their primary role in providing services and their primary role in urbanization that mirrors the tenets of the planning program that encourages urbanization inside of cities and future urbanization in UGBs. You've heard me talk about that before. This has become more complicated for many cities with the passage of Measure 5, Measure 47, and 50 that provided additional incentives to have that growth occur within UGBs and within side city limits. Although we, LOC, view this bill really as a band-aid for a more reasonable, more flexible UGB expansion process, again, we'd be happy to continue to work and see if we can come up with some amendments that will work for us.
Any questions of Ms. Ludwig? Mr. Tucker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I am here today mainly to follow up discussion that we were. First of all, I should mention I am on the DLCD work group as well, though I missed the first meeting because I was home ill. But so I'm involved in this issue in that capacity, but with a limited mandate from Metro, of course, and which I'm going to address.
Can I ask you maybe a weird question?
Sure.
Why would DLCD, on an issue dealing with Eastern Oregon, have a lobbyist from Metro?
My guess, Mr. Chair, is that the issue that DSED is discussing may be beyond Eastern Oregon. The bill here has to do with Eastern Oregon. But I, like I said, I missed the first meeting. I've been involved with this issue in previous capacities, I think. But I made it very clear when asked to serve on that committee that I'd be limited to Metro-related issues. So,
Randy, I apologize to you. You're not the person that put you there. Okay, so I...
No problem.
I just wondered if you knew why you were there, and you don't. So.
And he might not even if you had been there.
Well, I know why I'm here today, and you don't know that yet. So let me, if you'll allow me to tell you, I will. I'm here today with a very, very limited purpose. And as you pointed out, this does not apply to Metro. But you will recall, Mr. Chair, and those of you that were on the committee that are also members of the Land Use Review Committee, that we had a brief but animated discussion of this bill in Sandy when the Land Use Review Committee had its hearing in Sandy. Or not of this bill, but of this concept. And now that the concept has taken the form of a bill, I just wanted to state very clearly on the record that Metro is neutral on this bill. Our only interest in this bill, our one concern we'd like to ensure stays in the bill, is the language on lines 22 and 23 of page 1, which has this bill not apply in the Leonard Valley. So that's the only thing I wanted to say, and I just wanted to clarify for the record, because of any confusion that I think I created in Sandy, that in fact we're neutral and not involved in this bill unless something changes dramatically.
Any questions of Mr. Tucker? By the way, I've just been handed a note from Sean Julians, who is the legislative assistant to Representative Jensen. The current population of Hermiston is over 14,000 residents. So that's their concern of exceeding that 15,000 maximum. Any questions of any of our three?
That is an interesting question. Does that mean that the official population is the current year estimate by the Population Bureau of the Census? We're not talking about the census population. We're talking about the current year estimate by...
I have no idea.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, my guess is that we're talking about the yearly population that PSU does.
That's our official center for census in the state.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Stephen Shafari, Bob Rindy, and Elon Hassan. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Who'd like to start? Steve?
Probably have to. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We were involved in this bill last session. The bill, not too much dissimilar from what you have in front of you today, with the exception of a couple of limitations that we're putting in later, was in front of the legislature. A work group was set up. The governor essentially said, as the bill in its present form, will not get out of this building. And so some people who wanted the bill to come out of the building sat down and thought, what can we cut back so we can let the governor sign the darn thing? And so a limitation was put in. And what's happened this session is kind of come back and see if we can take some of those limitations and, out of the bill and get a second bite of the apple, and the next session we'll come back and get a third bite of the apple. So it's an interesting process, Mr. Chair. We watch down here, and people always come in and say, oh, we just want to have this little kind of bit. Sometimes we need to say yes or no. I think, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right when you say you're going to have a sunset on the bill, but we're not going to have a sunset on the bill. Let's make a policy decision about what ought to happen. I also want to thank Tamara for coming through here and making something, responding to Representative Nolan's question. And as she and I both were asking the same thing, we're serving this task force taking a look at the Curry County case and how we ought to be responding to it. And the problem is that we're making laws sometimes by anecdote. Here's one situation in one community, so let's pass a law for the whole state. How is this going to affect other places? We have the foggiest idea, because nobody's gotten the facts together. If there were a situation, Mr. Chair, where those facts are unascertainable, that would be one thing, but they're not. We can find out relatively quickly, and we're in the process of doing so, I think, finding out whether this bill is going to have a huge impact all over, or whether it's going to impact a couple of places and really doesn't make much difference. I think, Mr. Chair, it might be a really good idea for us to find that out before we start moving ahead, and that's the decision that was also made by this commission, the committee that's been working on this issue administratively to find out what is the nature of the problem, what's the scope of the problem before we start trying to resolve the problem. It reminds me a little bit, my guess is that if you'd asked the average Oregonian when they were voting on ballot measure 37, how many people are there like Dorothy English around the state? Most people on Wednesday have the furthest idea, and I still think right now, if you ask people in this room who are pretty up on land use, how many people do you think are going to find out, going to file ballot measure 37 claims in the next 5 years? Nobody knows. And yet everybody was willing to vote for something which they had no idea what the effect was going to be. So I think we're a little more at liberty of body, Mr. Chair, than the public at large. I think we ought to be taking our time and getting the facts, especially if we can get the facts. We have a time frame within which we can do that. So that would be one of my comments.
Mr. Kafuri, I might just add one thing there.
Yes.
Because this is the same scenario over and over again. If we don't do something about what the people of this state see as an injustice, then you're going to have a Measure 38 and you're going to have a Measure 39. It is time now to act, not to keep putting things on the back burner with interim groups that meet once every quarter. We need to do things now to help the people of this state. And I think we need to act in this legislative session, not outside of it.
Mr. Chair, I may not have made myself clear. I'm not suggesting that we pass this off to another session. I'm saying that this is not something we it's, have you heard the testimony? We're maybe a matter of months away or weeks away from having information in which we could make a decision. And I think we ought to wait until that happens before we operate.
I need to apologize to you. I was reading Mr. Rindy's comments.
Okay.
And thinking of his comments when I spoke to you, so I apologize.
Okay.
Bob, I'll get to you in a minute.
I'll accept your apology now.
I'm not apologizing to you, Bob. I'm apologizing to Steve.
I also think, Mr. Chair, that one of the things that could happen in this work group that you just heard testimony of the two people from the counties talked about is that the definition of what urbanizing use means has been size. And that may or may not be a good limitation. And it might be, as Mr. Slack said, that if we use some kind of other determination about what is urbanizable, we might come out of this committee and out of the legislature with a bill that is accepted by more folks and because it makes some rational sense. 3,500 feet sounds to me like a figure pulled out of the air. It doesn't seem to me like it was a figure that somebody sat down and calculated. And the more that we can make law based on knowing what the impacts are and some rational basis for those impacts, and I think the better off and the more less likely we'll have to be back here 2 years from now trying to do it over again or facing a ballot measure by people who are unhappy with what the legislature has done. So that's what I'm suggesting. I do want to make one other point, and that is that there are reasons for land use planning besides just saving preserving forest land and farmland. The reason for the urbanization goal is that public and private dollars are most efficiently spent when there is density of population and services. Now, that doesn't always work that population and services are in the same place. Sometimes they are for good reasons separate. You may have a mill out near the woods that's a long ways away from where people live. But as a general rule, it makes more sense to have commercial development and industrial development where folks live. So you don't have transportation costs, you don't have infrastructure development costs. That's the reason for the urbanization goal. It's a good idea. There may be exceptions where it doesn't work, and we have processes for doing those. But let's not just without taking a look at what the effects are going to be, overrule what's happened in the past.
Mr. Duncan.
If I may, thank you. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about your concept of urbanization, because it seems to me that in some of these rural communities, you've got one main thoroughfare, maybe two, on which you have all of your commercial and industrial lands, as opposed to places that you see in the Willamette Valley, where you have a whole kind of cross-section of streets throughout a city that spreads out the development. Wouldn't it make sense in those rural communities to be able to follow the path they currently have as to continue building along those one or two thoroughfares? I mean, what is urbanization in Eastern Oregon compared to urbanization in Gresham?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, I don't know the last time that you drove from Redmond to Bend was. But if you look at that, it seems to me the best example I can think of total lack of planning. What they have is one long strip development. And I think it goes against all of the reasons that we want to have land use planning for in terms of preserving the land that we have, land base, and condensing opportunities for living together and working together closely. You don't have to drive 40 miles out to buy a loaf of bread. I don't think that kind of that lack of planning makes sense. And if we had places in the rural areas where it does make so where people congregate, let's provide the services in those areas where people congregate. But to spread them out doesn't make much sense to me.
I think it's called growth.
Mr. Chair, growth is fine, but growth can be sprawl, or it can be planned growth. And growth as sprawl doesn't benefit anyone, Mr. Chair. That's why we have land use planning in the state.
Except the people that got jobs from that growth.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you take a look at, there's been a lot of talk about what commercial development does in terms of getting jobs. If you put a Walmart 3.5 miles outside of Klamath Falls, I'd like to say I don't think that adds any jobs. I think what it does is it takes jobs from people who are selling donuts and light bulbs and baby diapers inside Klamath Falls and moves them outside where they have to drive out there and back, and the people who want to buy those things have to drive out there and back, but it doesn't add any jobs. There's no new people working in that Walmart that weren't working at Joe's grocery store and Ralph's hardware store just a few weeks before. I don't think that puts new jobs in. I think so. One of the major fallacies.
Mr. Chair, may I one more? Just because I don't want to lose the point that I was pointing you towards. You gave one example between Redmond and Bend, but if you're standing in Ontario or if you're standing in Coos Bay and you're on one of those one or two thoroughfares that I'm talking about, and you turn around and look the opposite direction from the city, you're going to be looking at a farm or a ranch or a forest. And if we plan the way that it sounds like you're pointing us to planning, we may expand right into those lands. It seems to me these communities have decided not to expand that way and to rather continue along the trend that they currently have, which seems to make some sense to me. So maybe you can talk about why you think it would be better, instead of expanding along the common thoroughfares, to turn the other direction and go into those prime lands.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vacchio, I'm not going to sit here and draw a plan for Coos Bay. I'm not a professional planner. That's not my role. It is the role of the people in Coos Bay, the people in Ontario, working with local planners and within the framework set up by the state of Oregon and the goals by the state of Oregon to decide how they want the communities to be. I think that it's not inappropriate for us, however, in a statewide arena to give direction to how that planning is so that the people of Coos Bay and people of Ontario have a community that works for them.
I think you've just identified the great divide, and that many of us believe local governments should be doing that, not the state. Mr. Wendy, are you done, Stephen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure, I do need to point out that this man is my constituent. We need to be nice to him. He reminds me that.
Hold them ransom sometimes, Stephen, and ask for some kind of, you know, thing, and I bet you don't get a big response. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rendy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And as you did, LCDC also went out to Hermiston and held a meeting in the area nearby there and heard, I'm sure, much of the same testimony you did. And that, I think, was the beginning of what has many people have now before me have described as a subcommittee or a work group or what have you. But the commission agreed that there are big problems with what's essentially been left to us by the Curry County decision. Unfortunately, whenever a court overturns something that LCDC has adopted, you sometimes, maybe not always, but sometimes end up with just a vacuum. In the case of Curry County, I think what counties were left with is interpreting a very vague standard. And LCDC agreed in that meeting that it is LCDC's responsibility to give more clarity. You've heard it characterized as a rule of LCDC. In fact, there is no rule for what happens outside of communities on rural lands for the size of buildings. We've made some inferences that you might be able to interpret this way or that way. That's a terrible situation. We don't want to be in that situation. LCDC
asking the department to assemble a work group with interests, many of who are here today, to bring back to the commission amendments to the goal or rules or whatever it would take to recognize that there are many situations where it makes no sense at all to have limitations, but there might be some, and recognize those situations. That work group, I think, is going to bring a product to the commission. I can't give you a date. As usual, these kinds of things slow down when the legislature meets, mainly because all the people that are in the work group have to be over here. But we are trying our best to keep the momentum going on this, and we do think we will, in not too much time, have a solution. That is the reason that Director Shetterly asked me today to come to you and indicate that we cannot support this bill. We had previously indicated to you that we do support extending the sunset on last session's House Bill 2614, and we abide by that. However, we would not amend that process, especially to add commercial or in some other ways alter it. It is simply going to be something that would, I think, especially this bill and the kind of changes that are proposed, would make it, we shouldn't have the work group and do this. We should do one or the other. It is our wish to continue the work group and see if we can resolve this. And I think we will have a solution that has a lot more consensus if we can take the time, first of all, to really get better information about what the problem is out there. And we're working hard to do that. I think we're pretty close. And based on that information, get parties together around the table, which we've already started, and see if we can work out a consensus.
Any questions of Mr. Wendy? Bob, the problem I had and have is the line in your backup transcript of your testimony that says, quote, "The enactment of House Bill 2458 would complicate LCDC's efforts to address these already complex issues." You know, we could insert any House Bill number in there for the last 10 years and have that response there. And I say to you, sir, in all honesty, this is why you got Measure 37. You didn't respond then. I don't have confidence in your agency at this point that you'll respond to this within a reasonable time. There's people out there really hurting because they can't find jobs in this state. And we all need to be on the same track. Not in more committee meetings. We need to do something now. And that was a message I unfortunately delivered to Mr. Kefouri and not you. So anyway, Bob, that's just my opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps we chose our words wrong, but I think you understand our intent. We think we're on the way to solving this, and that's why we don't support it. We understand you certainly are empowered to proceed, and you may, but we did want to at least put that on the record. I need to answer earlier a question you had about why we would appoint Metro to our work group. This bill, or the current bill, or the law enacted by House Bill 2614, is limited to areas outside the Willamette Valley. But it's just a short fix, and it's got a sunset on it. The policy that we're trying to deal with here, and what should be the appropriate limitations on retail uses, industrial uses that are outside of cities, some cases far outside of cities, that's everywhere. That Curry County case applied everywhere. Well, 14 applies everywhere, so it's right up to the borders of Metro. It's a policy issue that I think will involve, it could very well involve a different solution for the Valley than for Eastern Oregon, but we do need to have all the parties at the table.
Thank you for that explanation. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Hassan.
Thank you, Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I am reading the testimony today of Mary Carl McCurdy, who is the lead attorney on this but could not make it down today because she's an ill child. I will do my best to answer any questions you have, and I will take those notes and get them to her and get you a timely response. I should not be able to answer anything. Quickly, 1,000 Friends opposes 2458 in large part because of the advisory committee that's been set up by LCDC to answer a lot of the questions that have been raised in this committee and that we see as complex and potentially difficult questions to answer, such as uses of groundwater, septic capacity, and roads with agricultural and other roads with agricultural uses and other regular uses that would arise on those roads should there be more development. The advisory committee is gathering this type of information now, and we want to see that process go through before we do anything else. As part of the problem that can arise from that, one of the things we're concerned about is that large urban commercial and industrial uses located outside of UGBs will require employees who live mostly in town to travel greater distances. A lot of the folks who are going to be paying the price for these locations that are set up far away from towns are going to be the employees who are going to spend time and money traveling to and from their jobs. The other concern then is that roads are going to fill up with folks who are going to stores farther and farther away, and that's going to have another cost in the community. Which brings me to my final point, which is that currently cities and towns invest in commercial and industrial zones and spend money to provide the infrastructure to support them. And outside UGBs will almost always be less expensive initially because there hasn't been that infrastructural development. The governors of industrial lands task force found that there are lands zoned for industrial uses in cities outside of Willamette Valley that are ready for development or would be with some additional investment, and we want to see what those lands are through the LCDC report and close the bill. I will do my best to answer any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Hansen? Stephen, did the planners have a position on this bill? Were you for, against, neutral?
The planners opposed to this bill at this time, Mr. Chair, because we agree with LCDC that there is a process working which we think can give a more refined answer to the situation. And those would be that we would have an idea, number one, of what the size of the problem is, whether what the impacts would be of passing the bill. And secondly, that we might take a look at a better, a more accurate definition of what urbanized is, whether we want to have a size limitation, whether that's the best definition or not. It sounds, as I said earlier to me, extraordinarily arbitrary that something like a 35-foot, 100-foot building can't expand at the size of 3,700-foot. On the other hand, there's a difference between that and saying, you know, build anything you want as big as you want, but don't worry about the consequences. We don't think that makes sense either.
Bob, I have a question. This advisory committee, I was unaware of it. How many times has it met?
Mr. Chair, it really did just get underway. LCDC established it, I believe, at their meeting. I think I recall correctly that it was at their November meeting, but it actually, its first meeting was about a month ago, and there are people in the room, I'm not part of that group, there are probably people in the room that could answer that accurately. We've only met once. We have another meeting coming up. That's our second meeting.
Do you have any kind of time parameters as to when this committee would have a conclusion or reach a recommendation of some kind?
We will be giving, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is no timeline, and it is often the case that when these work groups get together that they don't have a deadline. The LCDC hasn't given them a deadline. However, it is probably the case that it's going to work. It's going to go much faster after the session. I hope that they have a solution by September. I think that's been a ballpark guess. But as I mentioned earlier, it's very hard to have a meeting every 2 weeks like we would like to do while the session is in progress, because most of the members of that group are also here.
I'm not saying this to embarrass you, Bob, but I am saying it to embarrass the agency. If you take the same timeline you took in the Curry County case, it'll be past 2020 before your work group is done.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I am well aware that the LCDC has not dealt with this issue for a number of years, and there are some reasons for that. I know that there were a large number of issues raised by Curry County, and LCDC has dealt with them one at a time, and they've all been hard. And this one is the last one. I mean, we've gone through, but you're right, it's been taken too long.
I don't mean to be telling you how to do your business other than to say it hasn't been good enough, or we wouldn't be where we are today, okay? in addressing these type of issues. So, Representative Smith.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, and maybe it's for you. Didn't you go to Hermiston in July?
I believe so.
I think it was July, and Mr. Rendy said you attended that meeting. LCDC was there. Why are we now just doing the work group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we met, I seem to recall it was in the Grand. LCDC at that time expressed, heard very clearly from all those parties that we should do something, but they in turn indicated, I think clearly to the people in the room, LCDC had at that time, I think it was 4 or 5 major policy efforts underway. Amending Bill 14 to speed up expansion of urban growth boundaries, relaxing rules on extending sewer service to rural areas. We have transportation planning rule. I can't count them all. All of this has been extremely taxing, and so I think the commission was clear to the parties that we do want to get to this, but we already had to, we had to complete some things in order to simply have staff to do this. That's now happened. We've cleared some of this off, and we've started, but we had to have a hiatus to get some other work done.
Thank you.
Doesn't sound very encouraging for this advisory committee, though, based on what you just told us. From the standpoint of getting a decision made or a recommendation or something. You know, legislators, we want to solve the problem, right? I mean, we're all here ready to make a new law, but we do want to do it right. And certainly we want that type of information, but I don't see that committee before this committee. I don't see that chair coming here and saying, give us the moment. All I see is the LCD, which we see each other all the time. But are you getting my point here that your track record is lousy in this area? Not yours, Bob, but the agencies.
Mr. Chair, I think you would find if we were to bring you materials that in the last year and a half to 2 years, LCDC has engaged in and I think solved a significant number of issues that have been plaguing the agency for a long time. We got the message, I think, last time about several issues, and the legislature gave us the requirement and funding to solve a significant number of policy issues. We've done that. I think if you wish, we would be happy to come back, and I'm sure Mr. Shetterby would be happy to give you more of a sense about our recent track record. Excuse myself for the
And you're right, and I should distinguish the pre-Shetterly era and the post-Shetterly era. Lane's doing, I think, everything he can do at this point and has tried to do the right thing since taking over. So, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in Josephine County feel that Mr. Shetterly has made a real, and the department, a real effort to get down and talk about our problems, the Cave Junction area that really does have some problems. And I want to just comment on Mr. Hasson's remark that this might force people to move out into the country. I think that's probably a metro type feeling because people now in Cave Junction have to drive 25 miles to get to a job in Grants Pass. People in Grants Pass think nothing of driving 28 miles to Medford to keep a job. So 3 miles, to me, doesn't seem like much of a problem. We need to encourage people in those areas outside to form businesses in areas that are convenient to them, as long as we can keep the health problems under control, sewage and infrastructure. But it seems to me that nodes, for instance, we have a major mill, that should that mill go down, there would be no ability for anybody to take that over again. It would just die. Buildings out in the middle of the Illinois Valley that would be useless. Those could be changed into commercial, I would think. and nodes around people where they can easily get to it, I think it makes a lot of sense. So this kind of a bill, I think, really gives us flexibility to put people where they are and put them to work.
Chair Garland, Representative Henderson, I think I agree with you up until this bill does that. I mean, I think that's what the LCDC wants to find out is where are those nodes? I mean, are we going to do it in a place where we can put the jobs where the nodes are, and or are we going to put it somewhere else where the land is the cheapest, which is probably going to be farther away? In my head, I was certainly thinking 3 miles wasn't all that great a distance to drive. I was thinking more in the 35 to 40 miles, 50 miles, depending on where these things go. But I mean, I agree with you that we want that development in those node areas. I mean, I think that's a good thing. And on the mill record, I could be wrong, but my recollection is in the last legislative session, there was the mill bill which allowed for development of mills that went down, went out of business, that you have to be able to develop that area. So, and I think we worked with Representative Smith on that last session to allow that kind of development.
Mr. Vachter.
I think you hit the nail right on the head, Mr. Hassan, that we have to know where those nodes are. But the beauty of what we have right now is exactly what Mr. Kafoury said, and that's that each one of these local cities and the people that live there know where those nodes are. And if this bill helps grant a little power to those local communities to develop the way they need to develop in order to save themselves, then I think we've accomplished something.
Any further questions? Mr. Summer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm referring back to Mr. Levy's testimony. He told us that the lands in question we're talking about, they constitute, let me read this, rural commercial lands are two types of exception lands we'll hear about today, and they make up less than one-half of 1% of all private lands outside of urban growth boundaries. Is that a real big chink in LCDC's plans? That seems like a very small amount of privately owned land to have any resistance to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sumner, I don't know what that. I think that was expressed as a percentage. It could have been expressed as an actual number. And whether you could take that actual number and break it into 50 sites near or just outside of cities that might individually have something major or not, I think that is exactly what we're trying to find out. And indeed, the answer that we may get back is to agree with you that it is not. I'm just simply saying that the work group is just starting, and that's the kind of information we're trying to obtain.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, gentlemen. Committee, I think that what we'll do with this bill is ask Harmon Levy, Linda Ludwig, and Art Schlack to form a work group. I'm going to put this bill back up for a work session on the 2nd of March, and I'd like to see if you can address the city's concerns with this bill. And so we'll close the work session on House Bill 2458. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2458 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2484.
Yes, members of the committee, members of the audience, that this particular bill is one where it will modify a section of ORS or revised statutes that affects annexation. The annexations of property into city limits are found in two particular spots in the statutes, or in Chapter 222, and then also this one here is in 195. This particular section, there's a couple different ways that cities can annex pieces of property into the urban area. One is voluntary, the other is involuntary. The voluntary voluntary one is where the property owner petitions the city and then brings that in and goes through the process. The other one is involuntary, where a city or district initiates that annexation, and the pathway can be if the city limits surrounds a piece of property or properties, plural, and in such cases it's an enclave or an island, or the city can, district can come up with a plan and then annex other areas that are not islands. Currently, the current law says that there would be, in those, that particular case, there'd be an election. The election would be a simple majority. That's current law. This particular bill would seek to have what would be referred to as a double majority. The majority of the voters within the city limits or district as a whole, and also a majority of the voters within the area that is proposed to be annexed into the city limits or district. And that's the extent of the convention report.
Committee members, we don't intend to have a work session on this bill today. And we have 12 people signed up to give testimony. And I think this is this particular bill is of such interest that we will schedule another public hearing just for public testimony on this bill, which we'll take at a later time. But for right now, let's move to Bob Clay, Jerry Ritter. Yes, we make a quick comment. Move your microphone.
Very quick comment. The committee has in front of them dash one amendments to 2484.
And hang on a second, Representative. Those amendments have not been yet accepted by this committee.
All right.
Okay.
I was just that's what the purpose of it was to
all amendments.
The point that I wanted to make is that Sam pointed out that there's both 222 and 195 that are relative to this, and the bill at the moment only has 195 in it.
Correct. Any amendments that come to any bills in this committee will come to the chair for approval prior to being accepted by the committee. And we're not going to get surprise amendments coming in at all hours of the night.
This one did come to the chair, didn't
it? Yes, it did. This morning. Okay. Bob Clay, would you like to start off, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dear Chair Girard and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today. My name is Bob Clay. I'm a supervising planner with the City of Portland Planning Bureau, and we have some concerns about the effects of House Bill 2484. I do have some prepared testimony to hand out together with a map of the city. Let me just explain real quickly the map. The map shows some areas within the Portland Urban Service boundary that are unincorporated pockets, we call them unincorporated pockets, primarily in Multnomah County. This map does not show all of those, but it shows quite a few. It also shows a couple of areas that the city has urban planning issues that are not currently within our urban service boundary. For the most part, those areas that are identified on the map are unincorporated areas. So just to give you an idea, that even City of Portland, that is largely built up and largely surrounded by other jurisdictions, does have some unincorporated areas. What I've tried to do in the first paragraph of my testimony is just give you a little bit of background about the city's experience with respect to planning with our neighboring jurisdictions. We initiated what are called cooperation agreements in the early 1970s and the late 70s and the early 1980s with our neighboring jurisdictions. These agreements were required as part of the initial comprehensive plans and required by state law. The state law has subsequently amended these provisions about cooperative agreements over the years, such that today we have agreements that are what we call urban area planning agreements and intergovernmental agreements both. And the combination of the two of those then spell out the policies that the city has with our neighboring jurisdictions. The urban service boundary, distinct from an urban growth boundary, is that area in which the city has responsibility to provide urban services in the future. It's a delineation that's part of the cooperation agreement with our surrounding cities and counties. It's the area that, in which the city is expected to plan for
extension of services as well as the possibility of annexation in the future. And then I've mentioned our mid-county experience with Gresham. We've worked for almost a decade with the city of Gresham to annex Mid-Multnomah County under a health hazard provision in the statute, and so that's just by way of letting you know that we've had a lot of experience with annexation. Since that time, the city really has relied upon one of the other options for annexation, which is the what we call the property owner consent, which is simply property owners coming to the city requesting annexation, and usually it's in essence an exchange for connecting to sewer service. So it's the provision of the extension of services to that property in which the city then agrees to annex. Notwithstanding that, we know that there are a number of tools under the existing annexation laws, and our position is that we would not like to see an existing tool taken from the city. So the second part of my testimony simply is trying to outline for you some areas of concern that the city would have with respect to the opportunities to identify an area and go ahead and have a city-initiated annexation process under one of the options that currently we have today. As I read the bill currently, it will preclude some of the options that are currently available to us by going to this additional election process. So we've identified simply the issue of assuring timely and orderly development of the delivery of services, the cost and timing issue, and the ability for the city to meet not only its own obligations but also the Metro Regional Planning service delivery obligations with the expansion of urban growth boundaries. So for ourselves, we wouldn't want to see options taken away, and for our neighboring jurisdictions, we wouldn't want to see all the options still available to them on the table, because what happens immediately around our boundaries in terms of our decisions for investment in capital facilities affects us as well as those jurisdictions. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Greenberg.
Yes, I've got a couple. You have a new mayor who is your boss now. I understand he's taken each of the boroughs. Do you think he generally believes in the notion of democracy, that people all have a vote in there?
Representative Greenwick, yes, absolutely, no question.
A follow-up? If he does, you've reported there a set of balkanization agreements that you've made and how to divide up the territory, the spoils, if you will. Are the people who live within these areas that you've made agreements with your neighbors on where they're going to go, where their future is going to be, how they're going to live in the future, have they had any say in that, any vote in that, any representation in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, they have, through the comprehensive planning process or the development of a specific area plan, there's been opportunities for public involvement and citizen participation in the formulation of those plans. So, for instance, in the case of Pleasant Valley, which was an area that was added to the urban growth boundary, we had about a 2.5-year process working with people in that area as well as neighborhoods surrounding the area with Portland and Gresham to come up with a plan about where future Gresham would be and where the future of Portland would be and what the timing and delivery of services would be and the distribution of land uses. So that's one specific example that I'm very familiar with, where when you expand the urban growth boundary, Metro has a requirement that you have to develop under Title 11 a concept plan, and that concept plan is kind of like a mini comprehensive plan that must go through a process of public involvement.
You might involve just very briefly follow. Well, Portland's been involved in collusion with Beaverton to divide up essentially how my legislative district, House Section 33, will eventually be involved. And I have about 30,000 citizens in that district who don't feel they've been involved in that and don't think they'll have a vote on their future, including me as a
resident unincorporated Multnomah County, and many thousands of my my constituents. Is it your position, then, the City of Portland's position, or Mayor Potter's position, that they should not be able to have a vote on the future of where they live and what city they live in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, I haven't talked to the mayor specifically about this issue. I was asked to testify and come back down by the Director of Office of Government Relations for the city on this issue. So today, as far as I know, our position is that we wouldn't support this bill in the manner it is because it would reduce our options in the future. So I can't speak to exactly where the mayor would necessarily be on this issue. I can tell you that it's been the city's practice for probably better than a decade at this point to simply only go through annexations as a matter of property owner consent. So that's the system that we're operating under today, is that we annex with the delivery of services upon the initiation by the property owner.
I do need one more. One more. So you might accept a bill that allowed the City of Portland to continue to do what is your current policy and eliminate things that are not in your current policy?
Let's see. Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I think the city does not want to preclude options that we have today under existing state law with respect to annexations, which it appears to be in looking at what those options are. I think we have as many as 10 different options today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else, Mr. Clark?
That's it.
Any other questions of Mr. Clark? Thank you very much. Mr. Ritter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Ritter. I'm here representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. We are a coalition of citizens groups in more than 30 communities around the state. And our mission is to preserve and protect the public involvement in land use decisions, especially regarding annexations. We've been involved in every ORS 195 annexation plan in Oregon since the law was implemented back in 1993 as a result of Senate Bill 122. So we know how these things work. And Representative Greenlink, in answer to your question, by the time most citizens become aware of a 195 plan, it's considered a done deal by the city. Cities enter into urban services agreements and intergovernmental agreements to develop the plan. This all happens largely out of the public eye. The public doesn't become aware of it until the plan is fully conceived and then put before them. Now, that's bad enough, but then comes the final step of implementing the plan, and that's why we're here today. Because the final step under 195 is a vote of the city and of those in the targeted area. Now, the existing language of 195, sections 205 and 215, is unclear. The language can be interpreted as either a combined vote, as has been described, where all the ballots are thrown together and counted as one, or a double majority, as you find in ORS 222, section 160. The problem with the combined vote is obvious that the city population dwarfs that of the targeted area. And because of that, no matter what happens in the targeted area, the annexation goes whichever way the city voters want it to go. In Bend in 1999, the UGB folks voted 3-1 against the annexation plan. The Bend city people voted 3-1 in favor, so it didn't matter what the UGB folks said. Same thing happened in Redmond in November of this year. The lack of clarification in the language was exemplified in the last session, which I know some of you remember, with two diametrically opposed House bills, each attempting to interpret those statutes in either as a combined vote or as a double majority. The double majority bill got out of committee on a 5-1 due pass recommendation. The opposition, which I'll note is largely public entities, presumably funded by public money, was somehow able to keep it from going further, and we've never been able to understand that.
Cities insist that the combined vote is the only interpretation. We've already told you what the problem with that is. That's the most serious flaw in 195, and that's what House Bill 2484 will remedy, and that's why we support this bill wholeheartedly. 2484 will clarify the language as needing double majority, that being where the targeted area votes, the city votes, and both have to approve to make it happen. Cities are increasingly favoring 195 as an annexation tool precisely because the way they interpret it, it means that they won't have to deal with opposition and concerns in the targeted areas. Now, we're talking about Portland and Metro. Right now, the Portland Metro area is not allowed to use 195 because of a provision in ORS 268. However, Metro is going to ask you to revoke that prohibition. And because of that, there's tens of thousands of people, as Representative Greenlee mentioned, that are now staring down the barrel of 195's forced annexation guns, and they're not a happy bunch. I just heard the chair say, when we were talking about the last bill, that there is a need to do something about issues which people of the state feel are inequity and unjust. And there's thousands of people that feel that the way 195 is currently interpreted is unjust. A combined vote that shuts out those most impacted by the annexation. And I'll add to that, the people who put these plans together aren't really impacted by it because they're largely city staffs and planners. But the law that does that is, in fact, grossly unfair. That's how the Wayne County Commission referred to it when they denied Springfield the use of 195 back in 1994. That was the first such case we're aware of. It's also, the fairness issue was also cited by the Klamath County Commission last year when they insisted on a double majority vote if the city of Klamath Falls were to go after its UGB. So this is a classic battle of fairness versus expediency for city governments. We can't afford professional lobbyists. We're just citizens groups that have come here asking you for some help. We would ask that you side with fairness and send 2484 to the floor as written without allowing it to be watered down with a unanimous due pass recommendation. And I especially would like to thank the chair, Representative Greenlee, Representative Bakken, and other sponsors of this bill for raising the issue again in this session. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Hearing no questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Mr. Kafuri, Mr. Frensky, and Mr. Mugabe.
Mr. Frensky had a lead, and he did leave his testimony.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Mugabe? You are.
Thank you.
And Steve Kafuri, I guess, left too. Could we then have Ken Henschel and Mitch Rose come up?
I'm Mitch Rose, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity. I'd like to preface my written testimony with a couple of comments about who I am and why I'm here. I'm a 74-year-old retired professional engineer, but before I did that, I was a seaman for 15 years and had the opportunity to travel around the world very extensively. And that gave me the opportunity to see countries that don't have what we have here, where hearings like theirs are non-existent. And in appreciation of the differences that I've seen and nourished all my life, I have come out and involved myself in things where my wife says to me, "What are you getting involved in here? We have our home. We built our home here 23 years ago. We have a nice section that's not under dispute, and we don't have any children or grandchildren around to be concerned about parks and what have you." And I told her, "Honey," I said, "the most important thing in any discussion is the fundamental question about right and wrong. And I'm not pro or anti-annexation, but I do think the question of right and wrong is very important." We live in a changing world that is constantly becoming more complex. Those of you who try to serve your constituents are always facing conflicting interests and are assuring that no matter what you decide, there will always be those who criticize you and question your motives. However, you have now before you a matter that should be straightforward. It is clearly rooted in the basic tenets of the Constitution of the State of Oregon and the United States of America. In fact, it is strange indeed that the right to have a true voice in choosing one's government is even a matter of discussion. That right has long been a part of the heritage of every American, and to be debating it here and now seems unreal to me. Land use is a complex matter, one with arguments on both sides of every fence, and as you try to legislate in it, you quickly find yourself faced with diametrically opposing arguments, all of which have merit. Excuse me. The inherent flaw in a single majority vote is that the voters are, in effect, voting on two very issues. One group is being asked if they want to expand our city, if they want to expand their city by taking in more land and the revenue that it represents, while the other group is being asked if they want to be governed by people they have not elected and become part of a city that they may not want to join. Inevitably, the proponents of a single majority vote will have a significant numerical advantage that marginalizes those who favor a double majority vote. Measure 50 sought to limit government spending by limiting their revenue. It seemed reasonable that a reduction in income would result in a reduction in spending. However, politics are seldom reasonable. Limiting property tax increases to 3% a year while costs were increasing at a rate more than twice that amount forces cities to seek new revenues rather than cut back on spending. The de facto result of Measure 50 is to force cities to increase their tax rolls by annexation. When large corporations merge, they do so only after both have independently agreed to do so. Our nation grew through the process of annexing new states only after those states independently agreed to annexation. Why should those who live in the unincorporated areas be deprived of that same protection? So yes, there is a real dilemma facing you, and the solution will be difficult. But the right of every citizen to have a real vote should not be the price of that solution. I urge that you preserve the double majority vote. And I say, remember, next Wednesday, we celebrate the flag raising of Iwo Jima, an event that I think brings a lump to the throat of all freedom loving people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Comments?
Yes.
Just a very brief thing. Since I assume you're opposed to the notion of a single majority, you would be even more opposed to people being taken into a governance forum without any vote at all.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rose, could I ask a favor of you, please? We have a representative who wishes to give some testimony, and we do give a priority elected officials.
Yes,
I will have Representative Crummell come up for a moment, and then I'll ask you when he's completed, Mr. Rose, to you. That works out even better. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, of which Bull Mountain is part of my district. As a former mayor and city councilor, I have a unique perspective on annexations and how they can be attained and how they can be accomplished. I also have some definite ideas from the standpoint of what should and shouldn't be done. And thank you for the courtesy, Representative and Mr. Rose. I appreciate it. The there was a kind of a controversy when the city of Tigard decided that they wanted to take in 1,400 acres on Bull Mountain. How it, and in the city's defense, this is something that has been in the works for some time. However, as people were moving into Bull Mountain, I'm not sure that they were always necessarily advised that that was the case. Now, I'm not here to attack anybody for not advising them, because when a person buys property, they should always do due diligence, and not necessarily based on what somebody tells them, but what they are able to go find out from the governing bodies and that sort of thing. But I think that there had been quite a bit of misunderstanding with regards to the city of Tigard and taking in the Bull Mountain area. And when many of the residents on Bull Mountain were asking for help, I stepped in and asked for an opinion from legislative council and reminded the city of Tigard that they really needed to utilize majority rule. And once that was straightened out, we know what the results were with a double majority. And when the double majority was in fact utilized last November, the answer was, well, some folks on Bull Mountain would say not just no, but hell no. And some folks, in Tigard would say, well, they were, Tigard was very much in favor of it. But the idea is that about 90% of the folks on Bull Mountain turned down the measure. And I decided that I would sponsor legislation along these lines, and had a draft actually being requested, and then it came to my attention that you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenlick and Representative Avakian were all sort of pursuing the same thing. So I'm glad that we've been able to join forces in this, because I think we all have a unique perspective and areas within our district that this is affecting. And whether it's in the metro area or not, it really is irrelevant. If it's within the state of Oregon, if a city wants to annex an area that is a populated area, they should go and get the permission of those property owners before they try the annexation. And that's sort of the purpose of this measure, is to create that double majority. And the people during the annexing should say, yes, we want to take this area in, but the people being annexed should be able to say, yes, we want to become a part of the city, whatever city that is. So the bottom line, as far as I'm concerned, is that the double majority rule is really the only way, it's the only fair way to make sure that when annexations are going to take place, that that all parties have a real voice in what's going to be said, and especially in the metro area where we're seeing so much growth in the suburb areas. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop so that other folks can that came a long ways can testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but otherwise, if there's no questions, Mr. Chair, I will just leave.
Any questions for Representative Crummell? Seeing none, you're permitted to leave.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, Mr. Rose.
Certainly.
Mr. Rose, please excuse the interruption and proceed.
Not a problem, Mr. Chair. Chair Gerard, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Mitch Rose, and I'm the Interim Urban Planning Administrator. And I guess by the time I get my title out, I've probably used up my 3 minutes. But I'm speaking today on behalf of the City of Salem. Our legislative committee met during the noon hour, and I was talking to some of the committee members and the mayor about this bill, and they agreed that they wanted me to come over here and talk to you. I confess to being a little fuzzy on some of the language in this bill and in the three others that are like it that have been introduced. Won't keep me from having an opinion, of course. Basically, the City of Salem is very concerned about this bill and the companion bills. I think that's House Bill 3211, Senate Bill 380, and Senate Bill 491 that all deal with this question of the double majority for 195-215. We're concerned about anything that makes it more difficult for the city to annex land for some very basic reasons. Have a lot to do with efficient provision of public services, with taxes, and with good land use planning. Let me list the four main reasons why we're concerned. First of all, under state law, every city in the state is required to maintain a 20-year supply of vacant buildable land to meet its housing needs, its industrial needs, its commercial needs for future development. And every city in the state has done that, including the city of Salem. We've had an urban growth boundary in effect for more than 20 years. We've had a plan, a regional plan in effect for more than 20 years. We've entered into that with Polk County, Marion County, the city of Kaiser, and all the residents of the area within the urban growth boundary. That's been on the books for a long time, and among other things, it talks about the city being the logical provider of urban services like sewer and water to the area inside the urban growth boundary. It talks about that land inside the urban growth boundary being used for urban types and levels of development. In other words, industry, commerce, housing. If we're blocked from annexing that land or kept from annexing that land in any kind of a cost-effective way, we can't do that. We can't maintain that supply of land. And that's our first concern about this bill and the other ones I mentioned, that it keeps us from having that kind of orderly annexation of the land that has long been designated for urban use. The second concern we have is that it defeats the statewide planning program and our local planning provisions that are designed to have efficient public facilities and services, minimize sprawl, and so forth. Because we can't use the land inside our urban growth boundary for urban types and levels of development, we're going to have to go somewhere else. And we'll probably push out the urban growth boundary into some land that's less appropriate, more costly to serve, but we're still required to meet development needs. We're still required to find that land somewhere. So if we can't annex it here, if we can't bring in the land into the city here, even though it's inside our urban growth boundary, we're going to have to go find it somewhere else. The third reason we're concerned is because anything that thwarts the annexation process or an orderly annexation process makes it very difficult for the city to have the tax revenues and the tax base that it needs to provide urban services. And if that sounds like the cities are being greedy, I don't think it's that at all. The city in very many cases is already providing the urban types and levels of services to the development that's occurring outside the city limits. It's just that that development isn't necessarily paying for the full cost of those services. So that's the third concern. And finally, there's this question about is it democratic or not democratic? And I would submit to you that it certainly is not a question of democracy versus not having any democracy. There's been a lot of democracy gone into the development of the Salem Regional Plan and the Urban Growth Boundary. We had hundreds, if not thousands, of citizens working on this over the years, planning this, talking about how there's a need for this urban type of development to occur on those vacant lands just outside our city limits. And if we can't annex those lands and let that development occur, we're essentially thwarting that form of democracy that's been going on. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and be happy to accept any questions.
Mr. Ackerman.
Yes, I was interested in your comment that with respect to the city of Salem, the planning would be more difficult if the double majority, but you cannot annex a property. But aren't you assuming then that there's no other public entity to engage in this in the planning process when in fact the county is the planning agency under this scenario? What's the difference whether it's Salem would be the lead agency, so to speak, or the county would be the lead agency for local planning purposes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I'm not sure I fully understand the question. Are you getting at the idea of the service districts that provide the services just outside the current city limits?
No, what I'm saying is that I thought you said the planning is more difficult for the city of Salem unless it can annex these county lands. And I'm saying it doesn't make any difference, does it? Because the county still has land use functions of its own, whether the land is kept within the county or thereafter annexed to the city of Salem. What's the difference? We still have planning agencies involved at the local level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's true. We have entered into interagency agreements with the county. The county has adopted the same plan. But typically, what happens now is if the county approves a certain type of development in an area that's just outside the current city limits, it's often a type of development that is less urban and is less well served than if it could be in the city. and if it would be annexed to the city. And an example might be if we have say 10 vacant acres of land next to the current city limits, if that can be annexed and we can get the full range of urban services in there for police and sewer and water and so forth, that can develop an urban density of, say, 6 or 7 units per acre. If it can't be annexed, then it's going to develop probably at a rural density of, I don't know, one dwelling per acre, maybe on private wells, maybe on septic tanks, maybe with private streets.
Maybe a follow-up on that. I think that's correct. Where I live, for example, is an unincorporated area of Lane County within the urban growth boundary, and we have the same annexation issue. But we have the full gamut of urban services from the county or from other public agencies, public water, electricity, streets, sidewalks, whatever. So we have all the attributes of an urbanized society. We're just not within the city limits. Mm-hmm. So I think your assumption is that all property that needs to be annexed is somehow downtrodden or undervalued or doesn't have the public services is wrong. We are fully urbanized in Lane County, but we're not in the city. I think it's probably characteristic of the metropolitan area, but I'm not too familiar with that. So annexation becomes moot. We don't need you. That was my comment. Thank you.
Representative Greenwood.
Yes, thank you. You're not in my district, so I'll try hard to be nice to you. You do toss off the balance between efficiency and democracy, and of course there have been countries and other places who frequently have opted for efficiency and, as opposed to democracy in that kind of model. And I just wonder if you couldn't talk about that a little more, because it seems to me efficiency might be a 21st century concept, but democracy and the right of people to have a formal voice in their determination and in the form of government that governs them is pretty historical. And it seems after Measure 37 and other kinds of boasters, the notion to simply throw away the concept that the people in unincorporated areas really won't have a chance to vote on their future because it's not very efficient for the way the city is run sounds a little facile to me. Does that trouble you at all?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Greenlake, strictly giving my personal views here because I haven't talked with our city elected officials about that particular topic. But it's a question I certainly wrestled with, and I think those of you who may remember me coming in here and testifying in previous sessions know that I've been a very staunch advocate for citizen involvement and a pretty strong voice for environmental protections and for controls, having good controls on growth. Having said all that, I also value planning, and I think there's a fundamental issue here about the form that democracy takes. Planners often talk disparagingly about a system that you heard about in California called ballot box planning. You vote basically on practically every major development that comes to town. It's obviously a very democratic process in the sense that people get to vote on it. It may not be a very effective process in terms of the livability that those people experience in those communities. Very, very difficult to plan public facilities and services, for example, when you just don't know what's going to happen tomorrow on a given piece of land or in a given area. So I think it's a balancing process, and I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much emphasis on citizen involvement and land use planning. The idea is to get the people out early, have them decide the policies out front, and then put it into a plan and stick with it rather than keep bumping along making a new decision every few months.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Norman.
Thank you. Mr. Rose, did I hear you say that you have worked with the county on coordinating your planning efforts and your master plan and urban growth boundary?
Yes, that's
right. So has the county endorsed it, or what's been their participation?
Chair Gerard, Representative Nolan, I can't really answer that question, and I'll retreat to my title, which is Interim Urban Planning Administrator. I started with the City of Salem on November 1, and I just can't tell you the details of the history with Marion County on this particular urban growth boundary. I do know that the county and the city have engaged in, you know, all kinds of cooperative agreements about this, but I can't tell you the history of it.
If I might follow up.
Follow.
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot here with details, but I'm leading to a point that what you've said is that the county has participated in the work you've done through official channels. And am I correct in remembering that the county commission is elected by the people who live in the county? If I might follow up on that one. So everyone who lives in the county, including people who live in unincorporated areas of the county, are represented by people they have had a voice in electing in this process.
Chair Gerard, Representative Nolan, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, a follow-up in a slightly different avenue of discussion. Again, not trying to put you on the spot, but I want to use Salem and Marion County as kind of representative. You mentioned that in unincorporated areas of the county that perhaps might be in your urban growth boundary, the county is currently providing planning and zoning services for those properties. Am I correct there? And the county pays for that out of their general fund, am I correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
If I might just follow this line a little further. Do the property owners within your city limits pay into that general fund?
No.
They do not pay into the county's general fund?
Into the county's general fund?
Yes.
I'm sorry, it's the other way around. The city pays into the county, but the county doesn't pay into the city.
And does the county provide any planning services or zoning services for properties within your city limits?
No.
If I might just draw that to a conclusion. So, in other words,
You're getting more like an attorney every day.
Just trying to understand all that. It is, given the company I'm sitting next to right now. So you've got property owners who are in the city paying property taxes to the county. The county uses that money to provide services in unincorporated areas and does not provide services to some of the people who are paying that property tax. Thanks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, if you want to see a good example of this this evening, if you happen to head out for dinner, drive out toward the Lancaster Mall. When you look north, when you're on the south side of the Lancaster Mall and you look north and you see Best Buy and Bon Marché and some of the stores up there to the north, those are in the city limits. You look to your right and you look south and you see the Target store, and I think it's the Red Robin restaurant, a very urban-looking development down there. That's not in the city limits. And in fact, most of the development they see along Lancaster Drive between Center and State Street is not in the city limits. It's getting mostly city services, not all the city services. It's getting a lot of the city services. It isn't paying city taxes.
Mr. Chair?
I believe Representative Anderson.
Well, if you'd like to follow that same line of thinking.
Thank you. If the city of Salem wanted to annex an unincorporated area that was within the county, could the county veto that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Avakian, I'm not sure. I can't think of any way that they could do that. I think the process would be the one that's described here.
Which would be collaborative, but the county would not have the authority to stop the city. Maybe somebody later would, if they think different, could testify. Hey, but assuming that's true, then the county commissioners really would have no greater authority than the individual homeowners that are going to be annexed in stopping the city, correct?
Yeah. And in fact, the county has entered into an agreement that's reflected in our plan, our adopted plan policies, and the statement is worded should rather than shall, but it says the county should support annexation into the city for lands that are going to develop with or types of use, different types and levels of land use.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to deal with the democracy aspects that Representative Greenlee brought up, but I would like to talk with you about the efficiency. I can certainly understand where you have an island like on Lancaster that you have. My experience has been in Grants Pass where it's difficult for the police to know exactly what's in and what's out in terms of protection. It's difficult in terms of sewer and water. But it seems to me that those are the minor problems, that most of the expansion has been on the perimeter of the city limits. And unless there were a lot of land, I don't see what the real problem is, because most of these areas are already developed. There's homes in, and those taxpayers do not want to have their homes included, and yet the city's just continue to encroach further and further out. That doesn't seem like it's really an efficiency situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, typically what happens in these areas, if they aren't in an extended city, is a number of special districts are formed to serve them, and we have thousands of special districts in Oregon that are designed to serve areas like this. There are varying degrees of efficiency among those special districts, but what very often happens is you get a real sort of patchwork pattern of services outside the city, where maybe this area has city water, non-septic tanks, and it has a special district providing fire services, and it's getting county county police protection. And then right next to it's another property that's it isn't in the fire district, and it's on wells, and but it's somehow getting city police protection. So it's a real pastiche, and that. It often creates a lot of inefficiencies.
But don't the cities tend to create that by a mix in one area, then a mix in another, and then creating an island where it really is a difficult?
Well, and I think that's partly a result of our annexation laws. I've been in this business now since 1973, and if there's one thing I've observed over all that time is that there's a great disconnect between Oregon's annexation laws and Oregon's planning laws, and they're just like this. And the annexation laws were developed quite a bit before Senate Bill 100 and before we had the strong planning laws, and it's pretty tough to reconcile them in some cases.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Hensel.
Hensel. Thank you, Chairman and Representatives. I'm here, my name's Ken Hensel, and I'm here representing Citizen Participation Organization 4B, which is a CPO recognized by Washington County and encompasses most all of Tigard and most of an unincorporated area called Bull Mountain, which contains both incorporated Tigard citizens and unincorporated residents. And I'm here to present a resolution on behalf of the CPO that was voted on and ratified on the 6th of January. And you have copies of it, so I won't read to it. I can maybe add and summarize it for you. The citizens and members of our CPO ask that the double majority provisions be preserved. And having just lived through been in ground zero of the Tigard Bull Mountain, what's been referred to as a Tigard Bull Mountain fiasco on a recent annexation effort, we really have the pulse of the community on this issue. We are educational by nature and are not here to discuss the merits of whether or not this annexation was a good idea or not. It failed under the double majority provision. However, the Bull Mountain residents or voters voted this down by a roughly 90% to 10% majority, while the citizens of Tigard voted it in under the double majority if the measure failed. But
I think this shows clearly how important this discussion is on 195 and the single majority, double majority issue, because the residents of unincorporated Bull Mountain under a single majority scenario would clearly have been annexed into the city of Tigard against their will. And the citizens of the area through the CPO believe that that would have been fundamentally very unfair, and have passed this resolution in support of changing the 195 to preserve the double majority provisions of 222.160 and 268.354.
Any questions of Mr. Mitchell? Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. Let's see, we'll have Eugene Schoenheit, Lisa Hamilton-Dyke, did I pronounce that right? Dyke, I'm sorry. And Charles Armsby, please, come forward. Committee, we have one more witness after this to receive testimony.
Mr. Chair, I do need to leave, unfortunately. I just wanted to thank you for allowing me to sit down on your committee since I'm not a regular member.
Our pleasure, Mr. Chair, Representative. Good afternoon. Eugene, I'll let you go first.
Okay, I'm a resident of Oak Grove, and Oak Grove is a small, what we call it, suburb outside of Milwaukee, outside of Gladstone. We're kind of in the middle of things. Despite what the gentleman from Salem would lead you to believe about services, we have a fire district, we have an enhanced police district, we have a sewer district, we have water, we have county planning. You know, we have just about everything the city offers, except the bureaucracy, save a mayor. And what I'd like to say is if I was going to be annexed into a city of any kind, I'd like to vote on it. And we did a survey on our complete communities back in November. The county commissioners did this survey, and we surveyed the people in our particular area, and about 85% of them did not want to become a city. This is, you know, what the people actually want. This was done by the county commissioners. So, I mean, this is where Oak Grove is going. But I think I'll get down on, I'll cut to the real problem here, and I'm just going to explain how this works. But we have to look at this issue. If you take Max Sumner as being a person outside the city, and all the rest of your representatives being inside the city, and you go to vote, what happens is you're running a ratio of about 8-1. If four of you say, okay, I want to annex Max Sumner's area, you know, he's outvoted. No matter which way you look at it, he's outvoted. And what I'm saying is this is just a great bill. I mean, we just need to protect, you know, the rights of the people in the area, you know, to vote on whether they want to be annexed or not.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? We'll hold the questions till all three of you are done. Is this true?
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. I'm Lisa Hamilton-Pike. I'm a resident of unincorporated Bull Mountain. My husband and I have lived there for 11 years now. I am one of the founders. I'm one of the directors of Friends of Bull Mountain. You may have heard about us. Bull Mountain is an area of 1,400 acres, 2,600 households, and nearly 8,000 residents. My neighbors and I have been living and breathing the consequences of the ambiguity of ORS 195 for over 18 months now. Even though I have lived on Bull Mountain for 11 months, as Mr. Ritter testified, often those who live in these communities are completely caught off guard when one day they come to realize that a single majority vote may annex them into a city, and they didn't have any say in that process. Single majority annexation voting practices waste precious resources and destroy the goodwill necessary to successfully urbanize unincorporated territories. I am not personally opposed to annexation. I believe it makes good sense in many situations, but not all. But after having watched what happens to cities and territories divided by unfair voting practices, I adamantly oppose single majority voting annexation methods. Unfortunately, Mr. Fransky, who's been real active on Bull Mountain, he's a nearly 40-year resident of Bull Mountain, was not able to stay to present his public testimony. However, he did submit written testimony, and I would really like to draw your attention to what he's had to say. He understands the issues in depth. I do support his testimony 100%. I can appreciate there are those who believe single-majority annexation practices are important. I believe they've been called tools that cities need to urbanize territories. However, it's a defective tool that is not the quick fix that it may appear to be. The tool is broken and should be subject to recall. Cities would still be left with many other tools in their toolbox from which to work from to accomplish these goals. I guess it's very hard for me to understand how citizens could support single majority annexation votes. That's not what I see. It seems to be more cities and organizations and special interest groups. But I have to say, God bless the next city that attempts it. I would hate to be another city of Tigard having to go through this experience. I think it was a huge waste of money and an embarrassment to the city of Tigard, to Washington County, and to Metro. And I really think we can find better ways of accomplishing these goals. I don't know if any of you are aware, but some of us from Bull Mountain and Washington County and the city of Tigard have recently attempted to sit down and talk about crafting a mutually beneficial annexation plan, something I firmly believe should have happened way before the single majority annexation attempt, and something that never would happen under a single majority annexation attempt. The unfortunate thing is that this is going to now be 10 times more difficult because of the bad will that has been created. Although we are making our best effort, and it would certainly help accomplish the goal of getting cities or our territories annexed if we had more options at our disposal other than being annexed into one city and not being able to explore other more creative options that we've presented. We are tied into an urban service agreement, which more than pays its way for planning. As a matter of fact, there's a tremendous amount of money that comes off of Bull Mountain that goes into the cities and is not used in the unincorporated areas as we understood it should have been. So I believe Bull Mountain more than pays its way. And I just want to thank you all for the time and attention that you're giving this important issue, and I'd ask you to please support fair voting practices for all Oregonians. I would like very much to see House Bill 2044 move forward. Thank you.
Any questions? Mr. Ormsby.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles Ormsby. I go by my nickname a lot, Skip. I am here representing my reforming community, and that's called the Birdsill Community Planning Organization of Clackamas County, and I'm trying to cross over the county line into Multnomah County area to deal with drainage and topographical features of our area. I'm just going to tell you briefly about some principles that I thought of in terms of annexation law. Basically, I came into this process of annexation after a court, a long 2-3 year issue with the courts regarding my mother's estate, who is also here in the audience behind me.
Can you move closer?
Sure. Sure. My mother has lived in the Birdsill area for about 52 years now, and we would be subject to annexation to the city of Lake Oswego. But anyway, the principles that have come about by my thinking of it and dealing with it since about May of 2003 are essentially require a double majority vote for any annexation. Active solicitation of the communities involved around, in this case, Lake Oswego. Timely involvement of the communities. When are they involved? How are they involved? Do they know what the impacts of an urban services boundary are? Do they understand the issues of an intergovernmental agreement and the characteristics that they're trying to preserve in their neighborhood? They
they may have moved in recently, or they may have lived there a long time, but they don't understand these things. Transparent involvement with the communities. In other words, is all the information shared up front, forward, and appropriately outlined so people can get at it and understand it? Equal treatment of communities within an area. Around Lake Oswego, I attended about three or four of the annexation discussions that occurred during 2003. I was very concerned with the treatment of those that could afford legal representation versus those who could not. I'd say share control of resources with communities, GIS, geographical information systems, and share that information from Metro down to the neighborhood groups so that they can understand. Renunciation of tactics to cost out opponents, drag it on and run up legal bills that are, can become hideous for a community to absorb and understand. Anyway, as I said, I'm from Bird Source CPO. Our area is about 5 miles south of Portland, about 5 miles north of Oregon City, immediately on the Willamette River, and that's at about river mile 20, and immediately on the north side of Lake Oswego. We have about 240 to 300 acres. Elevation runs between about 30 feet to 300 feet, and the population, I estimate, is about 600. I'm dealing with four government entities, City of Portland, City of Lake Oswego, Multnomah County, and Clackamas County. Basically, when you look at the maps of Birdsville CPO, you'll see that our drainage areas are intertwined. One goes into the Willamette, the other goes into Tron Creek. Schools and boundaries are intertwined. Roads and transit corridors are intertwined. Tree cover and habitat is intertwined. Services and utilities are intertwined. I have, jokingly, I say, I have, it's the Noah's, what I jokingly refer to as the Noah's Ark of Boundary Conditions. I have two of everything except for sewer districts, and I think there's a menage a trois going on there between the City of Portland, the City of Lake Oswego, and Dunthorpe Sewer District Number 5, which is really the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners when they turn that bill around. Basically, what we found is, in our area, is dealing with the issues of cost and benefit, taxes and fees paid. Where are they going to be spent? How are they going to be spent? Which projects should be receive a priority? Should there be parks along the Willamette River in Lake Oswego or over on the far west side of Lake Oswego where the majority of the population lives? And what are the implications of to homeowners and of decisions made by urban planners without their immediate consultation on the planning issues that they're describing? Have they really been informed of it to truly understand the implications of an upzoning from R30 in our case to R7.5? Basically, as I said, I learned about ORS 195 in and around May of 2003. We were faced with an issue of being annexed into Lake Oswego immediately in an election that was proposed to be held in November of 2003. Basically, it felt rather acrimonious, to put it gently, between about six communities around Lake Oswego and the City of Lake Oswego. The articles are in the Oregonian and Lake Oswego Review. Some words were exchanged. By August of 2003, Lake Oswego had learned that they were facing a very strong uphill battle on this, and they essentially said, we'll put it into abeyance. And to their credit, they began to look for another way in September of 2003, and that was to John Turchi, city councilor, began to talk with the Clackamas County Dispute Resolution Center and eventually with the Portland State Graduate Program in Dispute Resolution. They came up with a program which was announced in the paper this past June, and I've served on a committee to work with this process called the Lake Oswego Community Dialogue Project. I suggest you pay some attention to that because it would give you a front-end process prior to the commencement of public hearings whereby the issues of annexation can be discussed, delineated, discovered before public hearings commence and the debate begins. Otherwise, problems will arise. I'd like to thank the State of Oregon. One thing I've been getting a lot of is how to map all this information that appears. And without the State of Oregon's help in the last legislative session,
getting the what's called OR map out on public view so people can begin to see their tax code areas, and that's determined in Clackamas County levy code areas and Multnomah County. They would not understand what is happening when the property taxes are collected and how they are applied to a particular area. In Birds Hill area, as I said, we have 300 acres and we have about 13 tax code areas, mainly between school boundaries and sewer boundaries. And without the understanding of that, I can't communicate that to my neighbors and community and to let them see or begin to see how their tax monies are collected and where they're going to. And I think that's imperative that people really understand that process. Not to mention other taxes and fees that are being collected. And so that's basically my statement at this time. Any questions?
Seeing none, thank you very much.
We appreciate you being part of this process and coming here today. Is Randy Tucker still here? Randy, you signed up. Do you still wish to?
Sure.
Okay, and Linda? Please, committee, I apologize for going as long as we are, but Mr. Tucker and Ms. Lovell are
entitled to.
Yes, while we're waiting for that, Representative Greenlick would like to introduce some written testimony.
Yes, I'd like to read a letter into the record from the Washington County Sheriff. It says, Dear Representative Greenlick, as I'm sure you're aware, annexation issues are on the minds of tens of thousands of Washington County citizens. I've had several opportunities in the last few weeks to communicate with many of them and listen to their concerns. Saying that, House Bill 2484, which gives voters a fair voice on proposed annexation, is exactly on point and appropriate. Citizens you represent are very thankful for the leadership you've shown in co-sponsoring this legislation. Thank you for taking prompt and responsible action to protect the interests of the citizens you represent. Sincerely, Rob Gordon, Sheriff. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Greenwood. Randy, would you like to go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Metro Legislative Affairs Manager. It took me a while to think of it. I'll try to be very brief. And I apologize, I was out of the room for some other meetings. If I repeat anything that has been said, I'll just urge you to keep in mind the famous words of former Congressman Morris Udall, who said, everything's been said, but not everyone said it yet. So I'm here to say it, whether it's been said or not. What I want to say on behalf of the Metro Council is that is actually echoed by the first part of the testimony of Mr. Morgavi, who testified a while ago, where he said, we live in a changing world that is constantly becoming more complex. Those of you who try to serve your constituents are always facing conflicting interests and are assured that no matter what you decide, there will be those who will criticize you and question your motives. And certainly the Metro Council feels that way about a lot of issues, and annexation is a very complicated issue that has a whole variety of facets, not just land use, not just the fairness to citizens, but also fundamental questions of governance and of government finance. One of the things that we see in the metro area, the metro region, is over time the fiscalization of land use, which is basically land use being used as a tool to address underlying issues of public finance and property taxes and that sort of thing. And we're just very interested in a larger scale look at questions of annexation and a longer term look. Mr. Ritter suggested to you that Metro would be coming forward with legislation this session that did the opposite of what this bill before you today does. That there is legislation that's been drafted, and I think it's printed as of today. We're not going to be pursuing that right now because I think this issue has mushroomed out in over the last couple of months in a way that we didn't foresee, and we certainly think it's time for a sort of a deep breath and a more a longer-term approach. And to that end, let me just notify you about something that's happening next week at Metro. The Metro Policy Advisory Committee, which is a committee established under our charter, which consists of local elected officials from around the region as well as citizen representatives from around the region, and some members of the Metro Council, is going to be having at their next meeting a mini symposium on this issue. That's next week. They're going to be inviting in the County Administrator of Washington County and the County Administrator of Clackamas County, and I believe the City Manager of Lake Oswego. We want to invite legislators that are interested in this issue to come and attend, there'll be maybe about an hour of presentation, and then there'll be time for some discussion. So that's next Wednesday from 5 to 7. And I wanted to let you know about that. There will actually be a letter coming out that will go to members from the region, and I'll make sure that all the members of this committee, since you're dealing with this issue, get notified about it. So basically, my short message to you is we're interested in having a big discussion about this issue, whether it takes place in the interim during the session, or we'd like to be at the table discussing with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Any questions? Representative Greenlee.
Yes, Randy. My constituents are quite worried if we hold off action by having an interim process and then showing up 2 years from now that, let's say, some hypothetical city like Beaverton may have...
whose initials are Beaverton?
Yeah, may have gobbled them up all the way to Gresham.
there is a three-mile limit there. Oh, no, that's incorporation, I guess. So.
I mean, if we need to have a big discussion on it, wouldn't it be possible to get a consensus group together right now and spend the next 3 weeks, the next 4 weeks... coming to some consensus? I mean, the process in the interim would be one meeting every 6 weeks that half of the people are on vacation for, and it's not really been in my experience, a very fruitful process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I don't feel like I'm really the best qualified person to answer that question because this is an issue that I'm just learning, becoming much more familiar with over the last several weeks because of what's been going on. My take, I think Linda can probably answer that question more effectively, although I don't want to put her on the hot seat, but my take would be that that a few weeks is probably not enough to come to terms with all of the different elements of this issue. Now, that's not to say that that nothing should happen for several years. That's not what we're here to say. And we've been interested. Actually, our chief operating officer has Michael Jordan, who is former county commissioner in Clackamas County, has a long-term interest in this issue that he started talking about long before this recent sort of explosion happened. I would like to defer and try to answer your question after talking to others. I just don't know that I can give you an intelligent answer. But I can talk for a while, even if I can't.
Randy, I can tell you if my email's any example, your statement that this particular issue is mushrooming very, very quickly is a very true statement. There is a lot of public opinion out there, and the longer it sits out there, I think the angrier it's getting. Okay. Good afternoon once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I don't want to take a lot of your time. It's late, but I do want to hit some high points on the 195-205 types of annexation, but also throw out a few thoughts and ideas, comments about things we've heard today, and about Representative Greenlee's comment about maybe taking a quick peek at this. Of course, the League is very, very concerned about when we start to nibble away at different forms of annexation. And I've provided you with my handy-dandy chart, which, let me tell you, has taken some time to put together. There's about 13 different forms of annexation in the state. And probably the only thing that I've ever agreed with Mr. Rose saying is that annexation policies and land use planning program do not match up. They never have. They haven't in a long time. Our annexation policies predated the program, and they're very, very difficult for cities, counties, special districts, and service districts to implement. That having been said, it's not going to be easy to fix them globally, to fix them statewide. If we could, however, look at a particular district and come up with some potential fixes in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I think that is possible. When we draw that out into statewide conclusions, those impacts become much, much greater on the annexations that are currently in process, and I think that would require a longer-term look that is more global, that absolutely needs to happen, and that cities, counties, special districts, service districts have been talking for the last couple of years at needing to do. We've just put it off in doing so because it's four different parts of statute, 13 different kinds of annexation, lots of different vote requirements, and believe me, you know, it's going to be a bit of a headache, but it needs to be done. It absolutely needs to be done. Senate Bill 122, a little bit of history, if I have the time, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
1993, it passed. In the early 90s, there was a whole lot of growth and urbanization happening in the state. Senate Bill 122 was the result of that, and it added cities into the cooperative agreements that counties and special districts, the urban service agreements that they were required to address for the provision of services. Those services were sanitary sewer, water, fire protection, parks, open space, recreation, streets, roads, and mass transit. Under Senate Bill 122, the urban service agreement was very intensive, as all the jurisdictions that have tried and have gone through these have seen. They specify whether a service is provided in the future by a city, county, or district, or some combination of, describing the role of each service provider in the future provision of that service, assigns responsibilities for planning and coordinating the provision of the service with other services, the constructing and managing those service facilities, the administering and managing the service to urban service users. The list goes on and on. But those agreements and that bill also specified several factors, primarily emphasizing efficiencies. That's what that bill was all about. We had lots of services being provided by lots of different people in the same areas. And you heard a gentleman here earlier saying in his neighborhood that was still a problem. Senate Bill 122 and those urban service agreements were trying to sort out those duplicative services, making cities, counties, service districts come up with these agreements, sign in blood, sign in writing, let me tell you that wasn't easy, and have agreements now and in the future about how those services would be provided. Because that was a process-rich, public process-rich, time-consuming, planning-rich process, it also established a new method of annexation for the cities that had concluded those urban service agreements with their providers within the territory that was proposed for annexation. To enable that new method of annexation, the city has to develop an annexation plan, which is, again, fairly time-consuming. It specifies the timing and sequence of annexation, the standards of urban service availability required as a precondition to that annexation, the plan schedule for annexation, the long-term benefits of the annexation, the findings about those long-term benefits, and the effects of the annexation on those existing urban service providers, such as counties or such as other service providers. Okay, once that annexation plan has been done and adopted, it is simultaneously submitted to the voters residing in the territory to be annexed and within the city in a single election. So all of that contains a lot of public hearings, a lot of public process. And that's what we primarily have seen in the past. There have been some glitches. There haven't been very many of these 195 annexations done yet to date since 93. We've only seen a handful. The last one we've seen was in November, this last November in Redmond. And it was the citizens of Redmond were very, very pleased by the process. It was a smooth process. Bow Mountain had some hiccups. I admit that. I was at several of those mountains, several of those meetings with the citizens groups. There were some hiccups there. And several of us instrumental in the 93 legislation have talked about those hiccups. I think Representative, the big representative from Wilsonville, Cromwell, mentioned time frame there was a potential hiccup. That Bull Mountain planning process, in order to get those urban service agreements in place, looked at 8 or 10 years. We saw a lot of change in long-term planning staff here in the city and within the county. We saw change within some of the council. We saw change in the neighborhood.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Well, there are even worse hiccups around than that, because you're talking about one particular kind of annexation problem, but the fact is members of your league are doing things, and I won't mention the city with the initials Beaverton anymore, but are doing things like...
Try not to be that directive.
I will. Like annexing, cherry stem annexation of the streets around a large area, and then claiming it's an island and claiming it can annex it without any vote of anything. I mean, how does that fit into your big long list of annexation miles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I really am not here to represent the city of Beaverton per se. I'm trying to give you an overview of annexation, this particular type of annexation, for all the cities in the state. My concern is primarily for all the cities in the state. Beaverton seems to be able to be handling its own policies and its own. However, what they're doing is not a 195 annexation what I was talking about. So I was talking about particularly the hiccups with the 195, if you'll excuse me. I understand there are issues with the city of Beaverton, and I do also understand that the city of Beaverton has issued a statement saying that they will not annex the Nike property within the next 4 years. Other than that, Representative Greenlick, I have no more information for you about what's going on there.
Nike's one of 190,000 people in Washington, in the unincorporated areas of Washington County, and in the urban growth boundary. Taking care of that problem would be very nice, but the other 189,999 property owners are also a concern.
So that leads me into into the comment about where we go today. I know we're talking today about 195 issues. I know there are some concerns about 222 issues that are definitely on the table.
And we'll try to get to those at the additional public hearings on this bill. So.
The league's recommendation at this point today would be you would be hearing not just from the league, but from counties, from special districts, from the development association. Let's take a comprehensive look at Oregon's annexation policies. Let's do that in a global manner. Let's come up with something that's a little more simple and do that in the relative near-term future. For all 13 policies, or all 13 types, I think we would be making a lot of forward progress. However, if there is a specific need that needs to get addressed before that time, I'm certain that we could put our folks together in a particular district or area to try to come up with some kind of resolve that maybe wouldn't have statewide application but would solve the immediate problem.
Now, Representative Graylin.
Thank you,
and I appreciate your helping me be more polite. Would the League support an absolute moratorium on any annexations while we do that, however long that takes?
An absolute moratorium on all 13 types of annexation processes, Mr. Representative?
Plus two annexations. Yeah, I mean, if you're saying let's sit back and take our time to do it, I think that's a reasonable thing. But it would seem to be reasonable inside an absolute moratorium. And we could pass an emergency bill with an absolute moratorium on any annexations until we take whatever time we want to figure out the problem.
Representative Gord, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenick, I think the League would be very hard pressed to take a position that called for a moratorium on all annexations given the economic climate that our state finds herself in. However, maybe we could have a conversation on the side and come up with something that might work for you specifically. I'm not sure what I can offer you in the moment.
Well, what would work for me would work for the rest of the counties that are worried about that. I appreciate the notion of we don't want to do anything precipitous that will have untoward consequences, but we also, it seems to me, don't want this to be a delaying tactic that would allow Klamath Falls to do things or Lane County, Eugene to do things, or I don't think any other county, I won't mention Beaverton in that context, to do things in the interim while we're seeking the ultimate solution to the problem. I mean, it seems to me either we try and get this thing solved and deal with the chair's mentioned email. I've gotten, I don't know how many hundred email, 99.9% in favor of making sure everybody has a vote in their future governance. That seems so reasonable to me. So you say that could downstream consequences, and it does. But if we don't do something, there'll be thousands of those people that will lose that opportunity to have a voice in the choice of their governance.
Mr. Chair, Greenick, I don't have a problem with taking that request back to my people and getting a response to you.
What period of time would you require for that, Ms. Ludwig?
Next week. Give me a week.
Would you come back to this committee next week with a response? And okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Does that satisfy you, Representative Green? Thank you for cooperating. Did you have more, Ms. Ludwig, on annexation?
No. As you all get more into this issue, it is very, very complex. If you have questions about the different types of annexations, please don't hesitate to grab me. And I'm more than willing to share information.
And the chair promises you will have ample time before this committee to explain the city's annexation and the history of annexation, because it's something the committee needs to know. So, any further questions? Thank you both. Appreciate your testimony.
Chair.
Committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2484 and open a work session on possible introduction of committee measures. Sam, can you go over those very briefly?
Yes, we have received, I think it is 6 drafts that have been dropped off to the committee from Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs, Oregon Exaction. Very briefly, I'll just go LC 1836, allows counties to establish rural zones for lands and not qualify as resource lands. The second one, LC 1838, allows for the siting of farm template dwellings.
Sam, do we have these?
You should have.
In our practice?
Well,
thought that we had provided in your packets for each one of those. And Representative Sumner is saying that his office received them.
Yeah, some of us do and some of us don't. Representative Eldon, do you have them?
It was,
can I just look in and use it? Let's go.
Sure.
Just introduce the bill.
Yeah. LC 1839 requires LCPC to adopt rules to allow for the siting of farm dwellings on less productive farmland by taking into account the size of the parcel, farm activities on the parcel, and soil class of the parcel. The fourth one, LC 1840, allows counties to designate rural development zones on lands that do not qualify as farm or forest land. Fifth, LC 1842 prohibits including land in a farm zone if the land is incapable of producing above a specified amount of income. And the last is LC 1843, which eliminates the minimum lot size and resource zones and repeals the farm income test. And that concludes the list of ones they submitted.
Any discussion?
Oh, Representative Dollar.
Are you planning on introducing these at the request of Oregonians in Action?
That it would be so stated, yes.
Okay. Representative Sumner?
Mr. Chair, I move LC drafts number 1836, number 1838, number 1839, number 1840, number 1842, number 1843 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Sumner has moved LC drafts 1836, 38, 39, 40, 42, and 43 to be introduced as committee bills as requested by Oregonians in Action. Is there any further discussion?
Just comment, Mr. Chair, if I may put in the record, be obvious that these are things that by accepting as committee bills, we as individuals have no particular position on them, and we're happy to support you in this.
Thank you for re-identifying your commitment on this vote, Representative. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Rima. Aye.
Nola. Smith.
Aye.
Sumner.
Aye.
Chair
Rose. And the chair votes aye. LC drafts 1836, 38, 39, 40, 42, and 43 are hereby entered as committee bills. And we will close the work session on the LC drafts. I thank the committee for their patience today. We will not have a meeting on Friday because we took a little extra time today to hear the vote. For those of you here on the annexation, we will be revisiting this bill as soon as we get some more of the data that I think that we need to look at, and we also have some proposed amendments to this bill involving the 222 section or the 220 section. So we wanted to have ample time to look at those and to have a good bill if it leaves this committee. So we thank you for your being here today, and we will adjourn this meeting of the House Committee on Land Use.
We think.